Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Nearly three decades ago, investigative reporters James Steele and Donald Bartlett wrote a series of articles for the Philadelphia Inquirer focusing on how Washington and Wall Street were systematically dismantling the middle class and widening inequality. The 1991 series, America, What Went Wrong, was so popular, crowds lined the streets around the newspaper's building to get reprints. The series was turned into a best-selling book in 1992. It is referred to as one of the most important works of journalism of the 20th century. The award-winning reporting duo are out with an updated version of their book, showing how the trends they explored back in 1991 have reached crisis levels. One example is taxes. They write, "The single greatest driver of income inequality in America is the U.S. tax system. Over the past 40 years, Washington has steadily cut the tax rate of the richest Americans. In 1980, the highest rate was 70%. Today, the top rate is 37%. All this has put more money into the pockets of people who already had a lot of money. This is why the gap between the wealthiest 1% and everyone else in America is greater than at any time in the past 100 years. Well, joining us now is James Steele, an award-winning investigative reporter. He's co-author of the best-selling book, America, What Went Wrong? And they added, The Crisis Deepens. Two of their eight books with Donald Bartlett and James Steele have been New York Times bestsellers, including The Betrayal of the American Dream. James and Donald worked together for more than 40 years. The American Journalism Review called them almost certainly the best team in the history of investigative journalism. And James Steele joins us from Philadelphia. Hi, James. Welcome back to the show. It's been a while. It's great to have you back.
It has been, Rose. It's great to be back with you.
Well, thank you so much. I was watching a couple of videos that you and Donald did over the years, and it's just so interesting to think that the series that you both wrote back in October of 1991 was a nine-part series, 70,000 words on economic policy.
Yeah.
That's just huge, especially when you think about where we are today. Tell us about how this series came about.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because it was an unusual experiment. Anything of that length is unheard of in newspapers then, let alone now. But the difference was we were looking at the whole issue of economics, not from a macroeconomic standpoint, not from what the stock market went up that day, not to what the employment rate was. We were looking at it from the lives of the people who were living in these jobs or who'd lost their job or who'd lost their health care, or whose pension had been decimated because the company raided it. We were looking at it sort of from the bottom up to see exactly what the economy looked like to them. So that really was what made the series different. We'd started out on a very small level. There were a lot of plants closing in the late 80s, and people said, well, that's just the way it is in America. That's the way we renew ourselves and we reinvigorate the economy. Don't worry about these people. We'll find other jobs, so on and so forth. So we began to look at examples of companies and plants to see exactly what was happening. That's the thing that Don and I have found over the years. It's like people have all these grand theories about this, that, and the other thing, but you have to kind of look down at the ground to see exactly how the idea is playing out. And what we were finding when we began to zero in on a lot of the companies is that many of them had been taken over by hedge funds or private equity companies out of New York, and loaded up with debt. And it was debt the companies couldn't handle. And so then they had to start cutting jobs and very often then selling the real estate of the companies, all of which had a really negative impact on a company that might have been around a long time. I would go out and interview somebody, maybe at a shoe plant in Missouri. Don would look at somebody in a glass plant in rural Pennsylvania. I went to a timber company in Martell, not too far from where you are there in the Sierras. Anyway, all over the country, interviewing people that this had happened to, came back, transcribed the interviews, And we looked at this and we said, this is a lot bigger than a plant closing series. This is a whole way of life for working class, middle class people. They're seeing their income driven down. They're losing their benefits. All the things that they were heading toward a secure retirement are being taken away from them. So it was a real eye-opener. At that point, we began looking at broader statistics, what people overall were earning, what tax benefits corporations were using to carry out a lot of these activities that were very detrimental to workers. So all of those things then sort of mushroomed and fed into the bigger series. But I'm really glad you asked the question, because it did not start out to be the big story it ended up. It was a much more limited scope, but it was only when we saw the magnitude of the problem, the millions of people it was affecting, and what the ramifications were for the future, that we then put the story together.
People were clearly hungry for this information because, as I said in the intro, and this is such an amazing visual to think about in today's times, that crowds lined the streets around the Philadelphia Inquirer's building to get reprints of your series.
I think the reason we finally concluded that this happened was that many people were struggling for one reason or another. They weren't necessarily unemployed, but they'd lost part of their income and they were having trouble making ends meet. And what we concluded, based on talking to some of them and letters we got thousands of letters, by the way, but from people who were waiting and so forth, we concluded that people realized that what was happening to them was not really their fault, that there were bigger forces out there that were manipulating the tax code, that were deregulating parts of the economy in negative ways affecting them, that the fact their pension suddenly wasn't there or was only a portion of what they thought it would be wasn't something they had done. People saw that what was happening to them was not of their doing. So you had all these hardworking people who'd played by all the proper rules, done all the right things, and suddenly the game had changed on them. And that's why the series had such an impact on them. And the same thing was true then when the book came out a few months later.
Maxwell King wrote the foreword to your book. He was editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer when you and Donald Bartlett wrote the series. He said that you actually received more than 20,000 letters and phone calls from readers telling you how glad they were that you told their story. Your book became a bestseller. It was on the bestseller list for 8 months, and it remained in print for years. And this really stood out for me, James. In the foreword, Maxwell wrote, "The great shock for us at the time was that because the book was so far ahead of the rest of the country, it did not change things."
Yes, I think that's a very fair statement as to how we all regarded things. It was controversial. I mean, people embraced the book at the time, embraced the series, but a lot of other people said, this is an exaggeration. There's nothing wrong with the middle class. The Wall Street Journal actually attacked us in a lead editorial one day. So you had people who had different views, and it took a little while, I think, for the country to catch up. And the main thing that was very controversial at the time, we were saying in that series and book that income inequality is going to be a really, really big issue in this country if we continue down the road we're on now. And, of course, that's exactly the road we traveled. And that's exactly why income inequality is at this horrendous level. And that's why one of the reasons COVID-19 and so many of the protests around the country in the big cities are a perfect illustration of people who are frustrated by income inequality, which has become embedded in our system over the years through various actions of Washington, Wall Street, and other bits of public policy.
Why did you both decide to update the book?
We decided because we obviously followed these issues for a long time. And we decided to update it because when you take the major points in the book, in the original book, and you update them, they're almost invariably dramatic changes. They're not just little edgy things here and there. The tax code has become much more unfair and much more skewed to the rich and the elite. Deregulation continued long after our book. And it deregulated the Savings and Loan Association, which was a crisis. And then, of course, the Great Recession was a wonderful product in part of deregulation. So, and pensions, which we said back in the 90s were threatened, we had no idea that pensions in the private sector would be decimated the way they've been. Today, and some of these statistics amazed us. I mean, Di and I deal with numbers all the time, so we're used to that. But in the private sector, in the private workforce, only 2% of workers in the private sector today working are covered by pensions. I mean, that's astonishing. You go back a few decades, and it's 30%. So, and it had been going up and up and up in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and suddenly we get to the 80s, and boom, the door shuts, and the reverse starts happening. And that has terrible ramifications for retirement security, for people in their 30s, 40s, now 50s. So all of the things that we wrote about, those trends have intensified. So that was one of the reasons we wrote. And a second one was we felt it was a time to make a stronger point that we need as a country to think about the way we're going to handle and solve this problem. Our first book, we did have some solutions, but they were not in the extent, not to the degree that we have spelled them out in the new book. The new book is a much stronger clarion call for a much more activist government. And we think the virus is a perfect example that shows the fallacy of the American system where you just let the market rule. The market ruled, and look what we got. And there's nothing wrong with the market. The market's given us a lot of great things in this world, but it has not lifted all boats. And, in fact, it is exacerbating inequality tremendously. So we're saying we need to think about this whole thing differently. We need to get more active. We need to develop a plan. We need, and there are a whole series of things we need to do to underpin the middle class. It won't happen in a year. It won't happen in 2 years. But we got to get started. It's a crisis level now, much more so than in the 90s when we wrote the first book.
To your point about only 2% of workers now receiving a pension, which is really shocking. As you write in your book, the New York Federal Reserve concluded in 2019 that 4 in 10 Americans, if confronted with an unexpected expense of $400, would not have the money to cover it, adding that over one-fifth of adults are not able to pay all of their bills in full, and this has just gotten worse because of COVID. More than half of working-age Americans have no retirement plan of any kind, more than half.
And again, all of these things are much worse than when we wrote the first book by far. And the point, it's interesting that Federal Reserve, I don't think any of us think of the Federal Reserve in New York as kind of a left-wing think tank by any means. I mean, they're just kind of as solid and as sort of conservative in their outlook of the economy and all that as possible. But when somebody, when an organization like that does a study like that and comes up with a factual bit of material like that, it tells you how bad things are. And we saw the minute COVID hit, we could actually see on our television sets this playing out in real life. Do you remember, like, just a week or two after the virus hit and companies started closing down, do you remember those images of people in cars and trucks lined up for miles getting boxes of food? I mean, these weren't people who were rounded up underneath viaducts, homeless people under viaducts. These were middle-class, working-class people who were living on the edge. They're one of those people that the Federal Reserve Bank in New York was writing about, who have no money for an emergency. And that's the kind of thing that we think is so urgent that we need to address in this country, start figuring out a way to really build a foundation so the middle class doesn't completely shrink away. And when something like this does happen, and things like this do happen, they've got some safety net to fall back on.
Today we're speaking with James Steele, an award-winning investigative reporter. He is co-author with Donald Bartlett of the New York Times number one bestseller, America, What Went Wrong? They wrote the book back in 1992 after writing a very successful series for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and they are out with an updated version. They added The Crisis Deepens. So we are going to talk about the changes that James and Donald have seen over the last 30 years and spend a lot of time talking about real solutions. If you have any questions or comments about inequality, the widening wealth gap, here's another stat from the book. In 2017, those at the top reported an average salary of $334,000. For those at the bottom, the average was only $22,000. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org, or you can tweet us at yourcallradio. Why don't we spend the rest of the show, James, talking about solutions, and then we'll talk about the policies that really got us here. Because I feel like sometimes on the show, we talk about the problems and then we only have 5 minutes for solutions.
Right.
So I think taxes, let's spend time on taxes. In the epilogue, How to Make It Right, you both write, tax rates should be raised on both the wealthiest Americans and large corporations. For individuals, the top rate should be increased from the current 37% to at least 40%. And higher for the wealthiest Americans. First off, James, do you think that people know just how much the tax system has shifted over the years?
I don't think they do, because the one thing that taxes almost, most people kind of glaze over when even the word is uttered. But the fact of the matter is, it's really what makes the country go or not go, depending on what you do with the system. So I don't think people have any idea that. You'll hear people bandy about, oh, tax rates are high. Well, sometimes they combine local and state with federal. But at the federal level, which is what the book is about, tax rates, by historic standards, are very low for the richest in the country. I mean, as recently as 1980, the top rate on some parts of your income was 70%. Today, it's 37%. So you can increase that without significantly changing the way of life of anybody who's rich, anybody who's wealthy. And we make that point in the book. And because what sense does it make to keep sending money to people who don't need it? The Trump tax bill had something in it that I find, I can't imagine any working person, if they knew of this statistic, could possibly endorse this administration. In that bill, everybody who earned $1 million a year or more got a tax cut of $64,000 a year. $64,000 a year. If you're in the heart of the middle class, let's just say $50,000 to $75,000, what did you get? You got $800 a year. I mean, that's not what saving the middle class is all about. Sending money to people who already have a lot of money, that's not the solution. The same thing was true on the corporate level. The corporate tax level was reduced from 35 to 21%. What's fascinating about perspective, and I'm really glad you asked this question about what do people know, if you go back just a little bit in history, you find out corporations paid almost 40% of the total amount of income taxes collected, both corporate and personal. This year, even before COVID, it's going to be less than 10%. Mm. So you have corporations no longer basically supporting part of our governmental operations the way they once did. All that shifted over to individuals. So taxes are terribly important. It's the money you have to finance programs. The other thing they're about is, if they're not skewed the wrong way, you don't end up with the income inequality like we have today. And that just keeps marching upward and upward and upward. That's what we found when we revised the book. So the more these things are kept in line, the more balanced a society you have. And in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, for example, when the American middle class grew in a very, very robust fashion, the amount of the disparity between those at the top and those, let's just say, in the middle, was pretty much the same during that whole period. You're always going to have rich people, and that's fine. Everybody understands that. Nobody disputes that, and nobody wants to do anything about that. But the gap is about the same. But from the late 70s on, particularly the 80s on, that starts to widen. And now it is just a chasm. So taxes are very, very important toward funding programs, but also making sure that income inequality is not the chasm that it is today.
James, I want to repeat some of these numbers. Trump's tax bill gave those earning $1 million or more an average tax cut of $64,000 a year. I was just thinking about how 40% of people who lost their jobs because of COVID made less than $40,000 a year.
Right, right. That's, it shows you. That's not what we need to help the middle class. That's not what's necessary. And this pattern has been true for years. Back through the 2000s and the Bush administration, all kinds of tax cuts were put in for dividends, capital gains, other such freebies of that sort. Back in the 80s, there were a whole range of tax cuts then. One of the few tax increases of any significance was under Bill Clinton. And it's funny, when it was put through, and I think it was 93, 94, during that period, conservatives all went up in arms. You're going to destroy the American economy. You're a job killer, blah, blah, blah. And, of course, I think anybody who looks back to that period knows what happened. The 90s were economically a very, very sustained period of growth for the United States. And the tax increase had absolutely no impact on it at all. The economy just went ahead as such. So nobody likes to pay taxes that I know of, but they are essential. You have to do that to pay for your government. You need it for your programs, and you also need it as a way to keep your society in some kind of general balance so that you don't end up with the sort of two-class society that we're developing now, with the very, 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 very rich people at the top and really everybody else.
So those who earn a million or more got $64,000 a year in tax cuts. Those who earn 50 to 75 only got 840. The other thing I was thinking about, James, this got wall-to-wall media coverage, but I rarely heard these numbers being repeated. You would think that we would all know these numbers by now, because they should have been repeated over and over again in the media.
Well, there's one number in there that I don't think I've seen anywhere, and that is, for those in the million and over category, if you take them as a group and you look at what kind of a tax cut they got, they are getting a tax cut the equivalent over the decade of the tax bill of $500 billion. Wouldn't that $500 billion have been nice to have invested in programs for the country as a whole, rather than sending that to a bunch of people who didn't need it? So, I mean, that in some ways is the heart of the book. I mean, inequality was what we talked about back in the 90s, but this is really the issue now. I mean, this gap is just getting so big, and it's happening because of things like that.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll spend a little more time on taxes and what it will take to change the tax system when you have even Democrats who don't like to talk about this issue. James Steele is an award-winning investigative reporter. He and Donald Bartlett wrote the number one bestseller, America, What Went Wrong, back in 1992. It was based on a series for the Philadelphia Inquirer in 1991. They've updated this book, and they've added The Crisis Deepens to the title. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation. The lines are filled, but you can always send a comment or question to the website, yourcallradio.org, or tweet us at Your Call Radio. The Sound of Dissent, what today's protest anthems tell us about this movement. That'll be the topic on 1A at 11 o'clock, one half hour from now, here on 91.7 KALW.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will discuss a new frontline documentary called The Virus, What Went Wrong. It takes a look at the Trump administration's failure to respond to COVID, even though they received repeated warnings. Who should be held accountable? Later in the show, we'll talk about labor strikes across the country in support of Black Lives Matter on Juneteenth tomorrow. And then next week, we are going to talk about the Supreme Court's decision to uphold DACA. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email us yourcall@kalw.org. And we're going to take phone calls in just a minute. The lines are full. You can also email questions about inequality, where we are today, how we can get out of this crisis, yourcall@kalw.org, or tweet us at Your Call Radio. James Steele is an award-winning investigative reporter. He's co-author of the updated book, America, What Went Wrong? The Crisis Deepens. We're going to take calls in a minute, James, but I just wonder on taxes. Here in California, the Democrats have a supermajority. They don't need one vote to raise taxes, yet they don't take it on because some of the Democrats are conservative. Same in Washington. The Democrats don't like to talk about taxes, you know, other than Bernie, Elizabeth Warren, some others. But what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it's decades of taxes being sort of tarred and feathered and creating the notion that it's a horrible thing. As I was saying earlier, nobody really likes to pay taxes, but I think an awful lot of us realize you have to have them and that there's a reason for them. But we've just had decades where they've been under that kind of attack. And the Republican Party for years has used that as their only issue. You'd like only significant issue, that and cutting red tape. That's about it. Beyond that, I don't think they have any issues to speak of. And I think to get around that is just Democrats need to be a little bit more forceful. I mean, if you look at Joe Biden's program, it's not as aggressive as either Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren's on taxes, but it's a lot more aggressive than what we've seen in the past out of Democrats. So it's possible, maybe just possible, that things may be turning on that point and people realize what must be done. The problem now, of course, is that COVID has come along and added so much red ink to the budget that's further complicating the whole process of dealing with these more structural big issues. But I think we've got to do it once we get behind the virus and once we perhaps have a vaccine. We've got to look at where we are and start putting in place the kind of society that benefits everybody. If we don't do this, it's going to be even worse for the working people.
Mm. Well, we have a comment about taxes, so let's go to Matt in San Francisco. Hi, Matt. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. How are you?
Hanging in there. Thanks.
Great. Thanks for taking my call, and thanks, as usual, for tackling such an important topic and having a really great guest on to help educate us all on this. I just wanted to mention what actually you all already started addressing while I was putting my call in. And that is just the notion that there just seem to be some fundamental things that don't get discussed nearly enough in terms of what got us to the state of, you know, really pretty terrible inequality. And when you look back, as was already just mentioned, we had a fairly progressive tax structure in place not too long ago, and that's been substantially degraded, you know, over these decades that you're discussing here now, basically, you know, you can call it Reaganomics or what have you, beginning in the 80s. And it just seems like, you know, that's just kind of such a simple starting place that it strikes me as it's too bad that that's not more often discussed. And just the concept of the marginal tax rate is really not something that's punitive. It's a structure that we all agree to, and we all pay the same rate of taxes on each incremental increasing amount of income that we receive. So that was really just my point. I just wanted to bring that up and get thoughts from your guest on that concept. I think we could make so much progress if we were all just a little bit more educated as voters about that. When you think of what's one of the most fundamental levers that we have in terms of maintaining some degree of equality in a capitalist system, it's a progressive tax structure, and we've strayed really far from that. So,
well, thank you for calling. James, your comments?
Well, Matt is absolutely right, and the progressive tax system is the heart of an equal system. I couldn't say it any better than he did, and that's the reason you have multiple rates. Even when rates were very high, it didn't mean somebody paid 70 or 90%. It just meant they paid on the last bit of their income, which might have been high. They paid at that rate. So they never paid those kinds of astronomical rates overall. And one of the things that has been very effective on the Republican side is that they talk about the complexity of the tax code. And it, of course, it is complex. And how they really want to simplify taxes. And they talk about putting it on a postcard or some malarkey like that. Well, the fact of the matter is, as long as you have multiple tax rates, even just four or five, you're still going to have a table that shows people what they owe. So simplifying the tax code, you still have to have the multiple rates. You still have some complexity. And that's why whether you have five rates or 12, it has nothing to do with the real complexity of the tax code, but it has more to do with fairness. The more rates you have, it means the fairer the tax code. A lot of people have trouble getting their head around that. But that's the way the system worked, as Matt said, for years and years and years. And it worked very, very effectively. It was really not until the 80s that people, rather than just getting rid of tax shelters, decided also to get rid of the high rates. And when they did these two together, that was the beginning of this snowballing situation that we're in today, where the rich seem to get tax breaks every time there's a tax bill, and everybody else gets a pittance, like a few $100. So the smartest thing to restore equity and eliminate a lot of the inequality would be some restoration of the progressive tax system. It was brilliantly conceived and operated very well for decades, but is kind of a shadow of its old self. So anyway, very, very good comment, Matt. Thank you.
Well, thank you for calling, Matt. Let's go next to Bill in San Francisco. Hi, Bill.
Hi. How you doing, Rose, James? I loved the two books, including America, Who Pays Taxes. In What Went Wrong, you mentioned that two-thirds of the benefits of Prop 13 and Prop 4 went to corporations, which I always held in my head. Is there any, while you talk about what the very wealthy got in tax breaks versus moderate income people, do you have any sense of what people with moderate incomes and low incomes have lost in terms of services? So in other words, a more complete accounting for, if you will, well-being or financial well-being?
Yes. Great question. And I'm sorry to say I can't give you any real specifics on that other than to say that I know that that's happened. Because when a lot of the federal taxes were cut beginning back in the 80s, certain things were shifted to the states. And the states very often, which most states do not have a very progressive tax system, couldn't just willy-nilly raise their taxes to pay for a lot of these things. So a lot of these services went by the boards. There's no doubt. I don't know what, I can't give an exact number on it, but I know that happened. And I think that's one of the points of the new book we make, which is different than the old book, is that there's no safety net out there for working Americans. And we talked about earlier in the show, the famous New York Fed study of about a couple of years ago that showed if half the country gets in an emergency, they don't have $400 in cash to pay for that emergency. That's a prescription for the kind of chaos and heartbreaking scenes that we've seen from COVID-19, as well as some of the other protests and demonstrations around the country. So that's the best thing we can do, is try to provide a financial underpinning for people with good jobs, with benefits, but the whole trajectory toward working Americans the last 40 years has been to take stuff away, not really give them anything. In some cases, you see new tax credits here or there for certain things for working people. That's good, but that's not the real solution. The real solution is to figure out a way to get them good jobs and to invest in the country that leads to that result.
Well, thank you for calling in, Bill. We should say that the measure to reform Prop 13 will be on the November ballot in California. I'm reading from the Chronicle right now. It would require that commercial and industrial real estate be taxed at its full market value, which would be determined by regular reassessments. Supporters say this will raise $12 billion a year for schools and local government, and we will definitely be doing shows about this. Today we are joined by investigative reporter James Steele. He is co-author with Donald Bartlett of the New York Times bestseller America, What Went Wrong? And they have added The Crisis Deepens to the update. James, we just got an email from Eugene. He says, thank you so much. I read the book when it came out, and it opened my eyes and completely changed how I teach my college classes.
Wow. I'm humbled to hear that. That's nice to hear. Very nice. And I think one of the reasons the book was in print a long time, but it did fall out of print just in recent years. And one of the things we wanted to do is not just bring it back, but then also to update it and show the progression of things. Because it's as much a work of sociology as economics or even journals, because of the stories in it, what's happened to people, and things of that sort. So that's a very nice thing to hear from that gentleman.
Well, let's go to another caller. Let's go to Raul in San Francisco. Is Raul still there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, Raul. Thanks for holding.
Thank you for having me. Welcome back as well. And one of my grave concerns over the years has been how these new movements on the right have been implemented. For example, with the tax issue, yes, taxes have always were never a positive word, but become a more of a dirty word. And my thinking has been, among other side effects, that monopolies are really what is happening, that the broadcast media has also been taken over. Individual entities have been abolished or run out of the field, and they've taken control, and it's been taking control of the media, so that you'll have perhaps, say, a candidate like Bernie Sanders, who runs and really doesn't get a fair play. There's very subtle negatives put out. So the control of the media is one of the elements that was essential to creating or moving back to this class inequality movement that took place.
Well, there's no doubt, and I can speak mainly about print, which I'm more familiar with than broadcast, but there's no doubt in the case of print, I think as we all know, there's been a shrinkage in the size of our metropolitan newspapers, our community newspapers, regional papers, which has meant less space to talk about big issues. worries all of us in journalism in terms of the future of democracy. And it's been compounded by, obviously, the Supreme Court ruling on Citizens United. It's put even more money in the hands of corporations. You know, it's interesting you talk about corporations and how things can control things. Some people in the press are constantly writing about Citizens United and say, this gave corporations and labor unions the right to finance any candidate they wanted, blah, blah, blah. Well, that makes it sound like an equal deal, right? Corporations, labor unions. Mm-hmm. Well, the corporations outspend labor unions about 10 to 1. So it's not even in the same ballpark to discuss something like that. They're not equal practitioners of that. But again, that's a criticism I have of my own business that doesn't make that particular distinction. With the electronic media, television in particular, there very often just doesn't seem to be the time. I don't know whether or not they're under orders on this or not. I think it's just merely a time issue to discuss truly complex issues. And at the heart of this issue is economic policy, tax policy. Very, very complex. And I wish there were more time given over to that. And I think because there hasn't been, it's one of the reasons we've found ourselves in the situation we're in right now. People just very often don't understand this because they haven't been able to read something that explains it clearly enough, which is what we've tried to do in this book anyway.
I've been hearing a lot of journalists and journalism outlets having these conversations about objectivity, activist journalism, what it means to be a journalist today. And I just wonder, James, since you've been doing this for a while and given where we are today with massive income inequality, what do you think a journalist's role is in today's time?
Well, I think some issues, I'll give you an example. Since we're on taxes, for what it's worth, some issues are always debatable. Like if you cut taxes, whether or not it stimulates the economy, does this or that or the other thing, some people say it does, some people say it doesn't. That's a case where you have both sides of an issue, and you can argue at both sides. But when you cut somebody's taxes, it is very clear who gets that benefit, and that is a fact. So I think one of the tricks is you need to separate those things that are clearly provable from things that are theories. And that's one of the things that I'm not so sure we always do in this business. But I think in general, though, the Trump era has changed everything because of the volume of the lies coming out of the administration have been so steady and so constant and in such a volume. Almost everybody's got a callus built up on their head because of so much of this stuff has happened. Normally, when a president would lie about something, somebody would pounce on it and show that this is a lie or this is an exaggeration or you're not telling the full truth, whatever it is. And the president might or might not apologize or clarify. But in this administration, there's been so much of this, it's like, I mean, it's just staggering. So it's like a different situation now that has complicated this whole process. I had a good friend of mine in the newspaper business, and I said, what's going to happen once Trump is out of office because of this problem we have now of the volume of the lies, basically? And he said, I don't know. He said, it's going to be like putting toothpaste back in a tube of toothpaste. So we're all facing that, and I think you're objective when it's a debatable point, but when you can show factually something is not the case, you're a journalist, you should show that. Mm. So I don't know whether that's subject or objectivity, but I think when there's factual material there that can shine the proper light on something, you do it. I mean, that's what we've tried to do in this book. Like some conservatives don't like taxes, but you can't argue with the numbers we said earlier about who gets the tax break and who doesn't. The Joint Committee on Taxation of Congress is made up of Republicans and Democrats. They're technocrats. they published the raw numbers from which I made those calculations. And
right.
In fact, I was so astounded by the calculation in the beginning, I thought, I've done something wrong here. So I kept running them over and over again just to make sure, because it just seemed outlandish that they would give millionaires a $64,000 a year tax cut and somebody in the heart of the middle class not even $1,000.
Wow.
But that's business as usual in America when it comes to taxes.
I want to make sure that we talk about people who are saddled with student debt. This is another very important section of your book. You write that the first federal student loan program was staffed by civil servants. Under Ronald Reagan, it was turned over to private companies whose executives used the program to enrich themselves.
Yes. Yes, I've actually written about student debt in the past. And what originally it was operated out of the Department of Education. But in the early 80s, it was that magic word came along called privatize. Let's privatize it, make it more efficient. Well, one of the companies that was part of that whole thing was Sallie Mae, which became the big conduit for essentially federally guaranteed loans. Well, one of the former executives of Sallie Mae made so much money managing that company that he built his own private golf course outside of Annapolis, Maryland. I mean, I don't mean like a private golf course like we normally think of ones where you might go in and put your application. No, this is his course with a bunch of his buddies. That's not what the student loan program was about, because whatever he was doing did not produce any efficiencies other than helping a lot of people get loaded up with debt. So we have to do something on student debt. It's at $1.5 trillion. It's right behind mortgage debt as the second most load of debt, and probably forgiving all the debt is not politically feasible, even among Democrats, but we've got to figure out some way to forgive it for the people who need it the most, or some other formula where you reduce the amount. Nobody knows how much it is, but a substantial part of the $1.5 trillion is represented by penalties, fees, and interest on the original debt. If most people were just able to pay exactly what they borrowed without any of the fees and things that piled up later, that figure, $1.5 trillion, wouldn't be cut in half, but it would be substantially reduced. And that alone would be at least a little better. But we need to find a way from this time on also going forward, not just to take care of people who are saddled with this, but to try to make sure in the future that we don't have more of this, because what's it going to be? People are not going to be able to start businesses, families. They're not going to have the usual mobility that we like to see in America. Student debt is a terrible crisis, and I've talked to a lot of people who have been saddled with it, and it's heartbreaking to me, who's older and went to a state school where, while I paid my tuition, the bulk of that tuition was paid by state government. Mm-hmm. And that's just not true anymore.
Right. And then you have to think about all of these young people today who are saddled with student debt. And in, 40 years, they're going to be taking care of their parents, who probably won't have a pension or any retirement.
Right. I mean, money that went into buying a house or putting aside money for your retirement is now going into retiring this debt. Mm. And some of the conditions of the debt are really, really heinous. And this is also one area where the federal government could make some changes. A lot of it is, of course, held by the federal government. And the interest rates they're charging some people are very high. They could change that. So there are things that can be done, and that's the point we make in the book. It's not a hopeless situation. We just have to galvanize the will and decide to do these things. It's debt, it's obviously jobs. The same thing is true of healthcare. Healthcare costs are being shipped more and more to individuals. Even people who have insurance are finding more and more of these costs coming into their homes and hitting themselves and their family, their children. So there's a lot of things we can do, and that's the point we make at the end of the book. We need to, as citizens, develop the will, elect the right people, and hold their feet to the fire until they get this done.
That was going to be my last question, James, in our final minutes. So many people are taking to the streets over police violence to support Black Lives Matter. It really is an incredible time. What do you think is the most effective way to really make something of this moment?
Well, I think the end of our book was actually written before all of this happened, but we did make some amendments to it. But I think one of the most important things that we see going on right now is that this is an opportunity as a nation to come together to develop the kind of social programs that benefit everybody. I think that's what we see in the streets now. In addition to COVID, not only did people lose their jobs and have no safety net, and not only are some of the people protesting, well, it's principally about racism and police brutality, also flowing into those demonstrations is income inequality. I mean, you see that in all of it as well. So at the bottom of this is we need to develop some ways to reduce income inequality so that everybody has a chance in this country. I mean, it goes without saying we need to end the police brutality, this horrible stuff that's going on. As a young reporter, I've seen it since the time I was a young reporter, so I know how far back this goes, and sometimes I think it's not getting any better. But if we can do that, we also need to deal with issues of income inequality. That will reduce so many frustrations and give people hope, where now in many cases they don't, not because they don't have the will to do things, it's just because there aren't the opportunities.
Well, James, thank you as always for your work. We would love to have you back sooner this time, and please give our best to Donald.
Will do. It's always great to be with you, Rose. Thanks so much.
Thank you. James Steele is an award-winning investigative reporter. He is co-author with Donald Bartlett of the New York Times number one bestseller, America, What Went Wrong? And they just updated this book to add The Crisis Deepens. You can find more information about their work at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance and David LaTulipe for keeping our studio running. And I hope you can join us for tomorrow's Media Roundtable. We'll discuss a new frontline documentary about the Trump administration's failure to respond to the COVID pandemic. And then we will also talk about labor strikes happening across the country in support of Black Lives Matter on Juneteenth. You can find past shows and sign up for our podcast at yourcallradio.org. Email us show or guest ideas and feedback, yourcall@kalw.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.